We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
Hi, guys, whoever you are. My name is Sarah. I am an alcoholic. I live in Santa Barbara, California. I have a sobriety date of October 23rd, 2017. I identify as an alcoholic because I was taught and I accept and I learn and I teach that I have the disease of alcoholism, but that does not necessarily pertain to the substance alcohol. We'll get there. What it was like for me from a very young age, I grew up in a somewhat dysfunctional family, divorce. My dad was an alcoholic. My mom was not, but she certainly wasn't normal, struggled with codependency, and she's an untreated adult child of alcoholics. And so just many layers of dysfunction in our family. And the healthier I've become, the longer I've been clean and sober, the more I've been able to recognize it. But of course, as a kid, your environment you grow up in is your normal. And I just barely, with a few years under my belt, am getting into more emotional sobriety now that I have a pretty confident handle on substance sobriety. Again, I will touch on that later. But growing up, it was me and my older brother, Jack. And I have another older brother, Michael. Jack died of a heroin overdose in 2014, I believe. He was 26. And he's a big part of my story. And again, I'm just kind of doing my random intro. And I hope to circle back to all of these points that I'm making. From a very young age, because I was the youngest, desperate for approval. Still, I get nervous sharing in meetings or leading meetings because I so want everyone to like me. You know, I want to do the right thing, say the right thing, be the right thing. And it's taken years and it will take more years for me to just be okay with who and how I am. But it was that feeling of never being good enough, never being desired, never being up to par. It created a lot of emotional pain when I was a kid. Again, my parents were split and I felt in the middle of their divorce. And my dad was a weekend dad and my mom was the custodial parent. So she was like bad cop, dad was good cop. I believe that my brother and I don't talk about my brother Mike very often because he's my half brother. So he wasn't as involved in my life as my brother Jack. My brother Jack and I were very closely paralleled in our disease and ultimately his demise. I always looked up to my big brother and I wanted to be like one of the boys. He always had a really easy time socially. He had lots of friends. He was a football star. I was more academic. I was the weird fat kid that always got to go to the fun, like Boy Scout troop rally races and camping trips and stuff. But I just was a tag along. I never felt that I had my own sense of identity. And again, it's only as an adult do I realize that I wasn't aware that was going on when I was a kid. My mom, bless her heart, always tried to did her best by my brother and I. She was a great parent, but some of her emotional issues very much got in the way of our healthy development. She's super codependent. I heard on one of the shows, Intervention, a phrase, and it's just so true and it's tragic, but she literally loved my brother to death. And that could have very well been my story. My mom just so desperate for us to be okay and wanting us to thrive. She never was able to establish healthy boundaries and hold us accountable. And again, I'm having to deal with that in my adult life now. But so anyhow, that just a little snippet of why I experienced emotional pain as a child, feeling different than, feeling not comfortable in my own skin. I've always struggled with my weight. Before I ever found drugs and alcohol, food was an escape for me. Eventually, I found self-harm. I cut and burned myself for very many years, and I got very good at being secret and lying about that and learning to live in the shadows. And my brother, I imagine, felt all the same emotional stressors that I did, but his disease developed quicker. The progression of his disease was more apparent. He would be UA'd for football, so they knew he was smoking weed. When he got kicked off the team for smoking weed, he was horrifically depressed. So then he starts drinking at a young age and then he gets in legal trouble. And so his problems were always on the forefront. My family always gave him a lot of attention as far as like, what do we do to help Jack? And me, although I was miserable and cutting myself and eating myself to death, they didn't pay attention to me because my grades were good. I wasn't getting in any trouble. I just wasn't happy. Very later in life, not very later in life, but not so much adolescence like middle school, but early high school, I start smoking weed. I have my own established friend group, starting to form some kind of identity. And then, actually, I just realized something right now. I started to form some sense of identity in my first high school that I went to with the set of friends that I kind of had from elementary school, and just, but I very much felt like an outsider. And my identity in that was we were all like churchgoers. We would do like missionary trips and Bible camps, and that's what we did. I was hanging out with all the good kids. And again, just separating my brother and I, because he was doing the bad stuff and I was literally going to Bible school. But I didn't feel good. I was chameleoning myself into what I thought I needed to be in order to feel a part of something. Ultimately, I had a girlfriend come visit me from, she had moved out here to California, and she came to visit me in Colorado, and she had kind of matured more than I, and she wanted to smoke weed and sneak out and go to parties. And so I did that with her while she was visiting, and some really tragic things happened. We were way inexperienced and hanging out with people who were way too old. And she and I both were assaulted at a party, and it was a trauma, what I know now to be trauma. But back then it was just, oh, let's just keep it hush hush so we don't get in trouble. So that was my first experience, negative experience with alcohol. But I didn't give it credit for what it was. I was just so mixed up in the, hey, they want to hang out with us again tomorrow. Do you want to go back kind of thing? And I remember when I confided in my friends at the time about what had happened to me, I didn't get the reaction that I was expecting. And I wasn't aware of the fact that I had expectations. At the very least, I just wanted someone to be nice about it and be like, oh, I'm sorry that happened to you, or tell me that it was okay or that it wasn't my fault. And it's no fault of theirs. They were kids and they only knew what they had been taught. It trickles down the family cycle. But the reaction I got from my church going friends was, God will forgive you for that. And I remember feeling like, forgive me for what? I didn't do this to myself. I didn't abuse myself at a party. I didn't take advantage of myself. Like, what do I need to be forgiven for? And it really put a bad taste in my mouth as far as the kind of people I thought that I was a part of and that I thought cared about me. And it just kind of fueled my deviation away from the way I was living. And then my brother and I, for a long time, because of that event, kind of paralleled each other in our addiction. And at first it's weed and alcohol, and then it's acid and ecstasy and Molly powder and raves. And he would get in trouble and clean up for a while and kind of chastise me, and I'd be going crazy. And then I might get a minor in possession ticket and have to go do some court classes. So I'd clean up for a bit, and then he'd be going crazy. It was just kind of tit for tat, unintentionally. We were just going back and forth. And my poor mom just never had any idea how bad it really was. And my dad is an alcoholic and, you know, would throw money at us when we were behaving and would not if we were in trouble. And I was just sharing in a meeting earlier that it's humbling as an adult now to see my parents as human. They're just people doing the best they can still. And it hurts my heart to think about them trying to parent us and trying to wanting to save us. And there's just nothing they could have done differently. And I don't know if they know that today, but I recognize that now as an adult myself. So eventually my brother and I both accrue some pretty significant legal charges. He and I both go to different rehabs in different states. We have multiple apartment leases, house leases, jobs. I never thought that my problem was that bad because I always had a job. I always had a place to live, but I would have a different job and a different address every month. And it took me getting sober and getting a squared away perception to realize, whoa, my life was unmanageable for so long before I finally realized that it was unmanageable because I just knew how to manage unmanageability. It was normal. When you're hanging out with people who don't care about a work ethic or who don't care about morals and values, it just feels normal to be flying by the seat of your pants, getting by with dishonesty, doing the bare minimum, not contributing to society, just being kind of a crummy individual. If the circle you keep is doing the same thing, that's what feels what is normal. So ultimately, the progression of my disease advanced from food to cutting to alcohol to drugs to really serious drugs. My grandfather kind of co-parented my brother and I with my mom, and my dad, like I said, was kind of behind the scenes. We would see him on the weekends. When my granddad died, it was another trauma. I helped my mom take care of him and die in our home in hospice care. Very hard on our family. He was definitely like the patriarch, and he was military, and it was just a huge shift for our family. And that was the first day I tried heroin. My brother had been smoking heroin for a long time. I had been taking Oxycontin for years, but that was the first day I crossed the line from party drugs or something prescribed to actually something illicit, a street drug. Side note, with Oxycontin, I had and taking care of my granddad in hospice care, my mother and I and a couple of girlfriends of mine and my sister-in-law ran a home health care agency for a long time. And it was really easy to have access to narcotics and people's money when you are power of attorney for these people and these families entrust you to take care of their loved ones. And there's no way for them to find out what you're doing. You know, I was misappropriating funds. I was taking advantage of these people, doing the bare minimum care. The guilt and shame and remorse I feel around that fueled my drinking and using for a long time. The worst of the worst of my story, outside of the way I felt about myself, like the worst thing I ever did, I was responsible for many people in different assisted living facilities, and liquid morphine would come in hospice kits, these cardboard boxes with supplies to keep people comfortable at the end of their life. And I got to the point in my disease that I would replace that liquid morphine with water, and I would take the drugs and replace and at the time, of course, I'm not thinking about the fact that that means someday somebody's going to be miserable, literally on their deathbed, and some good intended individual is going to be giving them something that they believe will offer them relief, and they're giving them water. And I could lose my composure thinking about that now. But, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, anytime I go to just feel like, what is wrong with you? That is a terrible thing. Like, you're a terrible person. That is what uniquely qualifies me to reach out to somebody else who has done something heinous and feels like there's no way out for me. How could anybody who does something that bad ever deserve anything good? So it did serve a purpose. And I don't know who I could have hurt with that if they found out. I don't know. Another thread in my story is that I always managed to squeak by. I should have had horrific charges for the things that I was doing. Elder neglect, embezzlement, any number of things. And after my granddad had died and I, you know, my addiction took off, not only doing pharmaceuticals, but narcotics. And again, nobody looked at me because I did my job and they were grateful for it. Not only am I breaking the law and mistreating people, but I'm getting praise and recognition for doing so because the families and my family were glad that they didn't have to do it. You know, I gave them the relief they were looking for. So nobody looked at me, just like when I was a kid, made sure my grades were up. So nobody looked at me when I was hurting myself and fueling my addiction. There did come a time, however, I had taken care of a woman for a long time, and part of her estate, when she finally passed away, there was going to be an audit on her finances. They didn't have any suspicion of anything, but they were just going to go through, fine-tooth comb what was left of her money, what happens to the rest of her money, things like that. And I absolutely would have been found out for what I was doing, you know, using petty cash for my needs and spending her money on things that just completely inappropriate. The jig was up. I thought about killing myself. Should I kill myself? No, not now. I'm just more oblivion by ingesting more substances to numb out the pain of my life is over. I'm going to go to prison for what I've been doing. The day before the audit, where I would have been found out, my covers would have been pulled. Forest fire happened in Colorado and the power of attorney's house burnt down to the ground, destroying absolutely every shred of evidence that would have held me accountable and probably could have, should have saved my life very many years before. Many more years of destruction. But it could have, should have been an instance for me to be like, okay, God, I hear you. I'll pay attention and I'll do better. I'll do different. And I didn't internalize it like that. It was just so, whew, that was close. And not only did I get away with what I was doing, but I didn't have to think about the pain I might have caused others with the wreckage I had created. And I just more incentive to use, more incentive to drink and use, and to numb the pain that I was creating, but nobody else knew about. Fast forward a couple years, my brother's using really heavy, in and out of jail, in and out of treatments. Even in our addiction, I maintained mine better than him. He got into guns, he got into crime, and I'm just smoking OxyContin and heroin in my living room. Like, I wasn't living as criminally as he was. He had gone to rehab for the third or fourth time and came back, and he was working with my dad and he was doing really well. And I was off and running. I don't even know if my family didn't know where I was at the time. The last time I saw him, my family took a trip to Estes Park in Colorado. And it's not funny. My poor mom had never seen me in the state that I was. My face was picked out. I was way underweight and I hadn't slept in days, but I had to go to this family trip. And I was like literally doing cartwheels in the back seat. I was so deep into a meth psychosis. And my brother, he and I were always very codependent on each other and covering for each other. So he's soothing my mom the whole time. Like, oh, mom, she's fine. Just leave her alone. She just needs to sleep. And I did get some sleep. And the next day, I remember seeing him. And the last time I saw my brother, he was sober. I was not. And he said, you better get your shit together in a hurry. And that was the last thing he said to me. And I was resentful about it at the time. And who do you think you are? And how dare you? Like, we've always done this together. And it was hurtful at the time. But man, I wish I would have known the significance of what he said to me at that time. The next time I heard from my family or spoke to my family after ruining our family vacation, which was cut short because of my antics, I got a phone call at my drug dealer's house from a police officer. My mom had hired a private investigator to find out who to contact to get a hold of me, to even let me know that pretty shortly after that trip, my brother had relapsed. Nobody knew. He was still working for my dad. She found him dead in her basement, overdosed. So that was rough, to get a call on your drug dealer's cell phone and be like, here, Sarah, a police officer wants to talk to you. And he put my mom on the phone and she said, Sarah, there's been an accident. Jack's dead. And I hit the ground. And of course, one more instance in my life that it should have been, okay, God, I hear you. I'll do something different. Should have been there for my family, should have recognized that this wasn't okay. Something needed to change, but so selfish at the time. I just used it again as more incentive to continue my wreckage, to continue my demise. Don't you know how bad I'm hurting? I have to feel better. Like, if you knew how I felt, you'd be using to kind of mentality. I managed to get a ride to my dad's house. They hadn't seen me in months. He took me to my mom's house. And of course there's, you know, family members and neighbors and friends milling around and they're bringing casseroles. And it's just, it's uncomfortable if you're a healthy minded individual. It's painful when you're sick. Just to be, you know, everyone's consoling each other. And I'm not only not able to handle it emotionally, but I'm physically withdrawing. And it was one of the worst days of my life. I wandered downstairs to where my brother's room was. And there was a little bit of blood on the carpet from where he had fallen and laid where my mom found him. And again, the healthier I've become, it's shocking that the amount of sickness that was in me. I, of course, was sad. But I didn't care so much about my family hurting and my brother being dead as I did about the sick thinking of, if he overdosed, there's drugs here. You know, if maybe there's money in his wallet. So I did. I found his wallet. I took the money that was in it. And I remember being so mad that the paramedics took the drugs that killed him because I needed them. I needed to feel better. I needed to be safe in my own skin to be able to face my family. And they weren't there. And thank God for the money that was in the wallet. And I coerced my mom into letting me out of the house. And I manipulated one of my brother's friends to give me a ride back to the same dealer's house to get dope on the day that my brother dies of a heroin overdose. So that was not even the lowest part of my addiction, but definitely the beginning of the lowest of lows. After that, when my family tried so hard to get me to go to treatment in the wake of his death, and you know, literally there was a plane ticket bought and somebody to meet me at the airport here in California, and I bailed, and that was the start of my most significant run in Colorado, at least. And I was that was the beginning of my IV usage and prostitution and more private investigators to try to find me and my family's desperation. And I just never wanted to be found. Ultimately got into enough trouble that I was arrested and had to do enough time in jail to dry out, to get some clarity, to call my mom and ask for help. And then they stuck me on a plane to come to rehab for the second or third time out here in California. And this time, instead of just completing rehab and going right back into Colorado and same people, places, and things, I went to a sober living in Ventura, California. I had a stint of sobriety there. I'd never worked my steps. I just thought that sobriety was the answer. I just needed to be clean and sober. And that was the check, problem solved. Now what? But I was just as miserable then as I was when I was a little kid and needed to cut or burn or overeat to feel better. I just was not at ease with myself ever. I did absolutely everything they say you're not supposed to do in early recovery, as far as meeting the man at the meeting and you're both new and, oh, it's true love. And you get the job to distract yourself and you buy the fancy stuff and just no program, no spirituality, just pure ego and validation and go, 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 ignore your feelings. So he and I got an apartment, played house for a while. Of course, shocking, led to relapse. Then he and I were using and committing crime together. Just like the horrendous behavior that I exhibited when I was taking care of people. I have a good family and I have a moral compass, and the kind of addict alcoholic I am when I ingest chemicals, I no longer care about humans as humans. You know, they are pawns to get out of them what I need. And if they're not going to give it to me, I'm going to take it. And that's what we would do. We would prey on people and learn their routine and break into their houses when they weren't home. And we knew they weren't going to be home because we had been watching you. Absolute criminal mentality. I was dangerous. I was a dangerous person to be in society. And that went on for a long time. And acting like that, when I have a moral compass, created more emotional pain, so more incentive to just drown out. Like, thank God for drugs and alcohol, because they numbed the emotional pain that was created by the things that I was doing, the behavior I was participating in, everything that I didn't want to be doing, but I had to in order to get the relief that I needed. Otherwise, I would have killed myself. Sobriety is the most painful thing I've ever experienced in my life. And that's why I had a really kind of negative view on, quote, recovery, unquote, because I didn't know what it was. I thought, why would I ever stop drinking and using when that's the only time I feel good? You people are crazy. And again, never mind the fact that I didn't take anyone's suggestions as far as reading the literature or following the instructions, but I thought I figured it out. So one more time, I get in enough trouble that I end up getting arrested. I was on the news. It was really ugly. If you Google my name, a mugshot pops up. And I laugh because anonymity is not something that I worry about, because I figure, you know, once you're on the news, your anonymity is kind of blown. But anyway, I end up doing enough time in Santa Barbara County Jail, that more time than I had ever done. And I was looking at prison for the crimes that I had committed. I was told I was going to prison on violent felony charges. But I remember that was the first jail experience that I had, that I was in there long enough that it started to become normal. And then normal started to become comfortable. And then I thought, I don't ever want to leave. I'm sober. I feel good. I have a routine. I don't have to worry about my stuff getting stolen. I don't have to worry about stealing anything, because they're going to give me what I need to survive. And it was enjoyable. I was in there with a bunch of other sick people, and it was like summer camp, and I loved it. Out of boredom, I ended up finding an AA book, and, there's a woman here in town. She still does H&I. I still see her. And she has no idea the significance she had in my life. I've told her before, and I've seen her at a meeting, and she just gave me a very humble, you know, thank you response. But she brought an H&I meeting in, and she shared her story. And I remember she just looked so beautiful and classy and put together and clean, like her hair was washed, you know? And she talked about herself in this way that I thought, no way, you didn't do that stuff. That couldn't be you. Like, you're talking about somebody else, because it didn't look like who she was and how she carried herself and the things that she said. And I thought, no way, no way. How did you do that? And she talked about the steps and the solution that she had found and how she found it and how it worked for her and how her life was now. And it just, it made an impact. It didn't blow me away. It wasn't like profound. I didn't want to like do AA right away, but I thought, huh, isn't that interesting? It was enough to intrigue me. Out of boredom, I pick up that AA book, and enough of us had been talking about AA, and I met a woman in there who's still a friend of mine, and she's still struggling with her addiction, but she had had success in program before, and she knew the book. So, and I was sober at the time, she wasn't, but she took me through a really rough version of the steps for the first time. And I'm still today, and I definitely was then, but as an addict alcoholic, I'm still addicted to feel good. I don't care what form it comes in. If it feels good, I want to do more of it. And that was the experience I had with AA at the very beginning in jail, is I felt better after accomplishing a task, reading an assignment, following the instructions. I felt good when I completed those things. I felt better after completing them than I did when I got the task. And just like leading, just like sharing for this podcast or leading a meeting or meeting with my sponsor or meeting with a sponsee, I don't want to do any of that. I don't want to do it. My first reaction is, nope, absolutely not. No, thank you. It'll be weird. It'll be uncomfortable. I don't want to do it. But after I do it, I feel good. I'm like, oh, there's the relief I was looking for. Just like on the street, I did not want to be committing the crimes I was committing. I didn't want to be behaving in the way that I was behaving, but I knew the relief I was going to get out of it if what I was doing was successful. So I had the incentive to do the things I didn't want to do because I knew relief was guaranteed. And that's still the principle I live on today in recoveries. I don't want to do any of this. I just want to sit in my bed and watch Netflix and never go to work. But that's not how life works. You know, you have to expel some effort to get a reward. And if the reward was not so much more than I ever expected, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. But I'll get more to that later. So I figured out in jail that, wow, I feel good. I want to do more of what this book says. I want to talk to people about what this book says. I want more people to talk to me about what this book says. And so then I start kind of clicking into thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous alcoholically. I wanted all of it. I wanted all of the feel good. God, before I knew it was God working in my life at the time, gave me an opportunity, instead of going to prison for my charges, because I didn't have as significant of charges as I did then. I was kind of like a first-time offender, at least in the bracket of offenses that I had accumulated. So I had a chance to have a suspended sentence to go to a treatment, to go to rehab, instead of going to prison. And if I messed up at rehab, I was going straight to prison. So they released me to the Bethel House here in Santa Barbara, California, which is the women's part of the rescue mission. And I was willing. I wanted to go. I was excited. I was so scared, though. And I remember thinking, like, my best thinking was, maybe if they let me out before I have to report at Bethel House, I can steal a bike, ride it to Ventura, get loaded, and find a way back before they find out. Just my best thinking is embarrassing. But they didn't even let me, give me the wiggle room to do that. And thank God they did it. They picked me up from jail, took me there, dropped me off, do the intake. I'm scared out of my mind, feel so weird. I'm wearing the clothes that I was wearing when I got arrested. Well, that's a fun story I should throw in. The day I got arrested in Ventura, I was prostituting to support my habit and robbing people. I'm laying under a bridge in the dirt. I'm not wearing any pants because of the evening that had preceded me. And I have a needle hanging out of my face. And no, I was not injecting drugs into my face, but I was so loaded the night before that I didn't even bother getting dressed after whatever I had done to cop the dope that I was doing. And I did my issue and I found that relief that I was looking for, to not have to think about the way I was living, literally like a troll under a bridge. And I fell out. And then somewhere in the night, something crawls across my face and I'm still holding the needle. And I went to swipe what was ever on my face out, and I poked myself in the lip with my needle. And the same second I thought, ow, that hurt. The next second I'm out, because I was so heavily intoxicated. So that's where I lay for, I have no idea how many hours. And that's how the police found me the next morning. No pants, needle in my face, classy. And I remember when they arrested me, I was bawling. I was hysterical. It was not because I was humiliated, It was not because I was devastated and my life is over and I'm going to prison, because mind you, I had felony warrants for months. They'd been looking for me, not for months, for years, actually, for the crimes that I was committing with my ex. But I was hysterical. I was devastated. I remember feeling worse than losing someone I loved, the feeling of grief and loss and not being able to understand why they wouldn't let me get well one more time. It wasn't because I was going to prison. It wasn't because my mom was going to have to hear about this. And it's just the fact that I had to withdraw. That was literally the worst thing on earth. I would rather die than feel that in my brain. That's what my brain told me. My brain told me I was going to die if I had to withdraw. That's why I ran from withdrawal for so long. So, and then I do the county time and I find AA, and the ball starts to roll in a different direction because I'm not the one kicking the ball in the wrong direction anymore. I wind up at the Bethel House in Santa Barbara, and I'm wearing the same clothes that I was arrested in. When they arrested me, I picked up a pair of pants off the railroad tracks and some mismatched shoes, and I just stink and it's gross and they're too small because I've been in there long enough to gain some weight back. And I remember after I get there and they give me some supplies and show me my bed and I take a shower and I'm like, hey, can I throw these shoes away? Cause they were disgusting being in a plastic bag for however long I was in there. And they're like, yeah, the trash can's in the front yard. And they let me walk out the front door, and I'm standing there in Santa Barbara and I'm barefoot. And I think, holy shit, excuse me, I shouldn't have sworn. I'm loose. I've escaped. They let me go. I should run. And then thank God for a moment of clarity. And I just thought, well, then what? You don't have a phone. You have no money. You know, nobody in Santa Barbara. Like, you can't call your family. Like, if you leave, you're going to prison. Like, all these thoughts are just like, yeah, I'm loose, but where am I going to go? And if it had been 1 hour, 1 day, 1 moment sooner than that happened, and I had that much less incentive to try this new way of life, I would have bailed. And in the year that I was there, I watched so many women bail on that thought of I get to leave, I'm leaving. So I give credit to my higher power in that moment that I just turned around and went back inside instead of running. You know, and that was not my thinking. That was a higher level of thinking that was given to me from something, someone in the universe that said, okay, you idiot, turn around, go inside. So I did. And my year at the Bethel House was the absolute best year of my life. Just like I miss jail sometimes, I miss rehab sometimes, because it was one of the first times of my life that I felt purposeful and I felt safe and I felt good in my own skin. And the more feel good I got, the more I wanted. And it just, at first you start at rehab and it feels like it's never going to end. How am I going to survive? And then you get to the middle and it just starts going real fast. And you're like, oh my gosh, I don't want it to end. Like, I want to live here forever. And then you don't want to leave by the time your time's up. So they taught me how to be an adult there. I grew up my year in rehab. And of course, you have to do therapy and self-help classes and yoga and mental health walks and all this stuff. And it just complemented my 12-step process so nicely. I would not have gotten out of the 12 steps what I did were it not for the personal therapy that I had in rehab. And I would not have gotten what I got out of therapy were it not for the 12 steps. They just paralleled each other flawlessly. But what I learned in rehab is that I'm an alcoholic. I have the disease of alcoholism. And what that means is I have used chemicals to the point that my organs are tired. They do not process drugs and alcohol the way a normal person processes them. I have abused them to the point where my organs don't know what to do with that substance. I've put so much into them that they go haywire and just think, okay, I'm not able to process this like I'm supposed to. Let's try again. Give me more. And thus ignites the craving. Once I have a little bit of a chemical, my body says, I don't know what to do with this. Let's try again. Give me some more of it. And it demands that I ingest more, past the point of consequence, past the point of logic, past the point of my desire to, I'm never going to do that again. There I am doing the same thing again. And there was all this evidence in my life to support the theory that, oh my gosh, this thing that they talk about in this textbook, this diagnosis as written by the doctor, that's me. How come every time I said, I'm not going to do this again, I would do the thing that I didn't think I was going to do? And how come every time my intentions were set and I meant what I said when I said it, my actions didn't follow suit? It's insanity. And as scary as that was to learn that I actually had a physiological condition, I had a disease, it was also such a relief. It did not exonerate me. It did not excuse my deplorable behavior and the awful things I had been doing and the way that I was living. But it was so reassuring to have an explanation. It was not a justification. I wasn't like free from answering for all the crap that I had done, but it was like, oh, that's why I did those things to those poor, helpless, relying on me for their safety, old people. That's why I treated society as disposable. That's why I could betray my family and not care that I was devastating them. That's why I could sacrifice my integrity and not care. That's why, because I'm a friggin' alcoholic. Thank God. Because were it not for that diagnosis, I would just be a shitty human being. I would just be the bad person that my actions made me feel like. So the good thing about a diagnosis is that if you have a diagnosis, you have a treatment. So it was simultaneously devastating and wonderful to learn, like, whoa, I'm an alcoholic. Thank God I'm an alcoholic. Now, what do I do about it? And then they taught me, okay, well, really simple. You read this book, you follow these directions, and you get this amazing life. Easier said than done. But same thing as the experience that I had in jail. Every step that I completed with a sponsor, every time I told the truth, when my brain said, I know what I'll do, I'll lie. And I got that ego boost, that feel good, that reassurance of like, wow, that felt good. That felt better. All these little incidents of proving myself wrong. It was amazing. It just felt so good. I became aware of the fact, I was taught the fact that my thoughts no longer had to dictate my actions. It used to be, if I didn't want to do something, if I thought I couldn't do something, or didn't think that I needed to, that my thoughts dictated my actions. It didn't matter what that thing was. My problems in life were astonishingly difficult to solve. Didn't matter if it was to pay a phone bill, show up to a court date, just tell the truth. My thoughts were, I don't want to do that. So therefore, I was incapable of doing that, whatever it was. Now, through recovery and rehab, I learned I can not want to do plenty of stuff, but my actions don't match my thinking anymore. I think all sorts of off-the-wall stuff, but my actions don't have to match. My thoughts no longer dictate my actions. My actions, in fact, dictate my thoughts. And that's the perception change that they talk about. And that's what I was taught when I was in rehab and have continued to learn and experience and try to teach others the longer I've been around and doing this. So I learned that I'm an alcoholic in rehab. I learned that there's a treatment for alcoholism in rehab. And the more treatment I gave myself, the better my life got. The more times I told the truth when it was scary, the more commitments I took and inconveniences I allotted for myself, the better I felt. And it was like, wow, this is why people do this. This is why people go to AA for the rest of their life. This is why people go to a meeting every day. I get it. It was like, click, got it. And then I kind of started, like I said, in jail, it kind of carried through to rehab. I was doing AA alcoholically. Like, you have to go to a meeting every day. And if one meeting's good, maybe two is better. And I was just kind of, it took me a long time to realize, like, okay, the point of getting healthy and being at ease is to not let AA monopolize your life. You make AA your priority, and then the rest of your life becomes amazing, you know, but it doesn't have to be an outweighed ratio. So that was what it was like for me. And that's what happened to me as God let me get in enough trouble, gave me enough rope to hang myself with, that I didn't die and I didn't have to go to prison, but I came pretty close enough that I had to look at my actions and got faced with, you know, some choices like do this or that, go back to what you know, or try something new. And I'm so grateful that I tried something new and I didn't leave rehab that day. And my experience in that place for the year that I was there is, you know, I wouldn't trade it for the world. A couple times in my life, my higher power has shown up. When I was in rehab, I was trusted to be the driver. I kept all my teeth and my driver's license in my addiction. I don't know how that's possible, because I literally couldn't keep my pants. Like, I don't know how that happened, but because I had a valid license, I was the driver while I was in rehab. And even that simple act, like feeling like I can't do that. I can't drive. I can't be responsible for all these people. But God knew better than I did. He was like, yes, you can. Just try it. Just do it anyway. My thought says, no, I can't do that. My actions didn't match. And then later it was like, wow, look at that. I proved myself wrong. I got distracted. I can't remember where I was going with my driving analogy. But every little thing served a purpose. I'm sorry. I lost my train of thought with that. But what happened? Oh, I get it. I remember now. I was driving one of the girls who had graduated to their sober living home. And I met the house manager at the time. And I remember thinking, dude, this is the best job ever. I have to do that. I want to do that. I want to be her. I want to live in the sober living and help other women and da, 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 da. And like my brain just decided that sounds amazing. That would be so perfect for me. And thank God I knew enough about recovery and humility and surrender at the time that I thought, okay, let's try to pray about it and to let God know what you want and then leave it alone. Leave it alone. And I didn't obsess on it. I didn't try to manipulate it to make it happen. I just kind of acknowledged it and remember thinking that would be great. And I just let it go. I gave it to the universe. And some time later, I successfully completed rehab. I met some wonderful people in rehab and the fellowship surrounding it. And I made enough friends that one day after I had moved out of rehab into sober living and living my life, doing the dang thing, and I was asked to be the assistant manager at the same sober living. And it just blew my freaking mind. Like God showed up in my life. Something that I thought was too good to be true, could never actually happen. Like he gave me what I wanted, all because I didn't seek it. I just did the work. And that was the result I got. And that resulted in eventually becoming the manager. And I've been there now for a few years. And it's just such a invaluable part of my life to get to work so closely with women in recovery. And I still go back to the rehab I graduated from and I volunteer there and I teach a book study and I sponsor women there. And recovery, the 12-step process, is so ingrained in my life and it's threaded through so eloquently in a way that I could never imagine. I recently got to adopt a puppy. Same thing. I remember thinking I would so love to have a dog in sober living and just in my life in general. And I thought, nope. You leave that alone. It's probably not the right time. Too good to be true. And it's a super long story, but just another example of how my God shows up for me and takes care of me. Like I now have a puppy when I thought that would be impossible. And it was impossible. In fact, I live in a place where you can't have dogs, but I get to have a dog with permission. And that's just a teeny tiny example of what has been proven to me in this program, that you just do the work and you get the results. You get better results than you think you want. What my life is like today, I have been through some gnarly stuff sober. I've found two of my dearest friends dead to overdose. I've lost family members, career changes, relationships, you know, life is in session. And very rarely do I think, you know, it sounds good right now, getting loaded. Today, it's more like, you know what sounds good right now? Lying. You know what sounds good right now? Procrastinating, breaking a commitment, neglecting responsibilities, overeating. Like those are the things that threaten my serenity today. But I learned early on a foundation in AA, like grassroots, work your steps or die, recovery. And it's removed my desire to drink and use. Like I no longer have that obsession. And if I don't give into that obsession, I don't ignite that allergy and I'm at no risk of relapse. I'm no risk at relapse if I treat my disease daily. Just like when I'm in my active disease, I'm not at risk of withdrawal if I ingest a chemical every day. That's how I view my recovery today. If I do some kind of program every day, talk to a sponsor, talk to a sponsee, prayer and meditation, go to a meeting, read a daily reflection, something to treat my disease, I'm at no risk of relapse. The flip side of that coin, I, as an alcoholic, drug addict of the hopeless variety, I am guaranteed to relapse. I'm guaranteed to if I don't treat my disease. At no risk of relapse, if I treat my disease on a daily basis, I have a daily reprieve contingent on my spiritual maintenance. But I also have to stay humble and remember that if I don't do that, I will answer for it eventually. And that does not mean that I'm going to drink right away if I don't go to a meeting every day. But every single thing I do in my life is one step towards or one step away from a relapse. And I might have a pretty wide threshold. I might have very many steps to go back to before I'll actually pick up a chemical. But I will start participating in behaviors that aren't so spiritual. They don't feel so good and are not esteemable. And all of that stuff creates emotional pain. And eventually my emotional pain will rise to the point where the consequences of a relapse are irrelevant. And I don't care because I've allowed myself to get so uncomfortable that I must find relief. And I'll believe the lie. It'll be different this time. Nobody will know. I got this. It's okay. Just get loaded today. Get back to normal tomorrow. and I act on that lie, I ingest that chemical, my allergy kicks off, and my disease of alcoholism demands that I continue, even though I intended to just have one. It's not a big deal. It won't be that bad this time. And if I did not have that clarity that I learned in rehab, like I would not have been able to recover, because I thought that I just had to stop drinking and using. I thought that fundamentally I was okay if I could just get the heroin out of the way. And I'm just so grateful for the people who taught me that, you know, for that shred of willingness that I had out of desperation and fear, and just to try something differently, even though everything in my body said, no, do the thing that you've always done. Then way early on in my recovery too, again, God working in my life before I gave him credit, people taught me in the beginning, like, I'm going to teach you this, but in order for it to work, you have to teach somebody else. That's how it works. There's no other way. And of course, there are very many different ways of service. And another thing I was taught in the beginning, the severity of your condition dictates the severity of your treatment. And that's with any medical condition. Doesn't matter what it is, cancer, diabetes, MS, food sensitivities, however sick you are, is how much treatment you require. So there are some people that don't have to sponsor and are able to live happy, successful, productive, contributing lives in AA. But I don't get to compare my condition to theirs and think, well, they don't sponsor and they're sober and they seem happy. That's great for them. The severity of your treatment dictates, the severity of your condition dictates the severity of your treatment. For me, I have to follow the instruction of my sponsor that suggested, if you don't think you're as happy as you want to be, why don't you try some more service work? Why don't you try to do that scary thing that nobody in the beginning thinks they could do? I can't possibly sponsor someone. I don't have anything that anybody wants. That's for somebody else. I'm gonna humble myself and allow somebody else who would be better at that job to help somebody. But even that is a selfish decision, a thought that I base in myself, thinking I don't want to do that. So therefore, I'm going to manipulate it in a pretty package. But really, it's just me saying no. So I took a chance on following my sponsor's direction to sponsor women in the program, even though I was scared out of my mind and did not want to do it. And it has resulted in a life beyond my wildest dreams, a life that continues to get more wonderful as time passes. If AA didn't work, if following the 12 steps and praying to a God of my understanding, and that understanding changes sometimes, if it didn't work, I wouldn't do it. And the day I want to get loaded, I'm going to go do that because I can, but I don't want to get loaded. That's the beautiful thing about recovery. I'm not white knuckling. I'm not forcing myself into submission. I'm not making empty promises. I don't want to. I have no desire to drink and use today. That's the side effect of my program, and it's glorious. I can see the truth today, and my truth used to be based in lies, but I needed to believe that it was true in order to survive the emotional pain that believing lies created. I never know when I share like this if I'm making sense, if I've explained it well enough, but if I could leave you with anything, it would be just to in the beginning, don't trust your intuition. Those thoughts that we think are true and the ones that we've been living on that have just resulted in more wreckage, like to run and to lie and to hide. Don't do it. Try something differently. Try to follow a suggestion. Try to complete an assignment that somebody gives you. And if it doesn't feel good, hey, no, I can't blame you for not. But it's been my experience, the scarier or the harder something presents as, the better it feels when I do it. And then that gives you incentive to do the next scary, hard thing. Just like working out. You don't see results right away, but you don't have to work out for a year in order to get any relief. You do a little bit of work, you get a little bit of results. You do a lot of work, you get a lot of results. And it matches itself. You earn incentive to continue, and that incentive results in relief. And it's just a good life. It's a good life today. I never, ever, ever wanted to stop drinking and using. Drugs and alcohol never failed me. Part of my story is not what I hear in the rooms. And quite frankly, it scares me. I don't think I would have survived it. When people say, you know, it stopped working. Didn't matter how much I drank, I couldn't get drunk. Didn't matter how many drugs I did. I didn't find relief. That's terrifying. Drugs and alcohol never failed me. I never wanted to be separated from them. I did not come into program out of desperation of wanting to stop. I came into program because the consequences of the thing that I wanted to keep doing got in the way of doing it. And I was separated long enough to just get curious, to play around in this thing. And it's resulted in this glorious life. I hope that somebody got something out of this, and that, you know, you try, you read that book, you follow the instructions, you trust somebody else for the first time, even though it's so scary. And if it doesn't work, you can always go back to what you were doing before. That option never ceases to be available. But who do I think I am, thinking I'm the one alcoholic, I'm the one addict that it's not going to work for? I'm different than. I'm so much worse than anybody else on planet Earth. This can't possibly be for me. And I proved myself wrong. And I didn't really talk a lot about spirituality and God, but I found that the closer I am to program and the closer I am to the people in program, that's my direct link to a God in my life. You know, I see God in nature. I see God in people. I see God in animals. Living in Santa Barbara, this close to the ocean, it's just like you really cannot deny the presence of some kind of higher supreme being in life. And in the beginning, anytime I would struggle with that concept, a man who's near and dear to my heart taught me. He's like, you know, think, dumb it down. Think about it. Do you think about blinking? Do you think about breathing? Do you think about digesting your food? Are you responsible for any of those things? No, they just happen. I just do them. I do not make the sun rise and set. I do not make plants photosynthesize, the tide of the ocean in and out. Those things just happen. I'm not responsible for them. So I can acknowledge some kind of power existing there. And I don't have to know what it is. I don't have to even have reverence for it right away. I just have to acknowledge, whoa, I didn't do that, but there it is. And that's all I needed in the beginning to just like keep moving forward. You don't have to understand all of it. My black and white thinking definitely at times threatened my progress, and I just kept moving forward. It talked a lot about willingness in the program. And thank God, again, somebody else just gave me a snippet of information that has saved my butt so many times. You don't have to be full force, all the way willing, gung ho. You can put as many willings in front of the word willing as you need to. You just have to be willing 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 to maybe possibly find out. As long as the answer is not known. No, as long as the answer is not no. The most expensive thing you will ever own is a closed mind. You know, if you shut your mind to this thing and believe it's not going to work, it won't. You don't have to believe it will work. You just have to believe that maybe it will. Be willing to find out, to prove yourself wrong. I'm so grateful I did. And I'm so grateful I found people in my life to refer me to other people in my life that wind up with me sharing my story on this recording. I never expected to be doing things like this. But when an AA request presents itself, I say yes, even though I don't want to, because I know that if other people had not done that for me, I never would be where I am today. And I would not trade the life I have today or anything I've done in my past for anything. I'm so grateful, and I value my experiences, and I know that there are so many more to come, and I only hope that I can help somebody the way that I was helped in this fellowship. So thank you, Tara. I think that's all from me.
Sarah, you are really good at this. Nobody that just listened to that would believe that you were nervous when you started.
Well, thank you, because I still am.
That was fabulous. Do you do public speaking? And if you really should.
I have to check my ego every time I do a share, because everybody always tells me that. I get this glorious feedback, and I still have that imposter syndrome. You know, my brain says, no, not me. That's not for me. But thank you so much. You know, I still am working on accepting compliments, and I thank you. Thank you.
I follow quick speaking and quick thinking, and you're eloquent and you're quotable and you have passion. And most importantly, Sarah, you have so much honesty that you're not afraid to put on the table. You're all out there. And I do have some questions, but I'm just going to commentary here for a minute. So I'll apologize to the listeners who can't stand me, because, you know, I want everyone to like me. So I'm sorry. But you made that comment, like, I can lose my composure just thinking about the things I've done. It's something of that nature.
Yeah.
Because it's so upsetting that you were that person, but you're this person today. And then you talked at the end, you're talking with this deep knowledge of the disease, and and how this disease made you something that you weren't. I mean, you didn't say that, but you were talking about this deeper understanding of the disease and how.
Yeah.
Do you learn that in your role working, or did you learn that through the program, the 1 year program that you went through? Do you do outside reading? How do you have this deep understanding outside of the books and the steps? Because it's clearly there.
I was just, again, a God shot in my life, really fortunate in the beginning that I was let out of the rehab to attend a book study that was led here in town by a man who's still my friend. And just his teaching of the 12 steps, but in addition to that, the disease of alcoholism, to really understand the medical diagnosis. And it's in the doctor's opinion, but it was taught in a way that it was like nuanced by incorporating the real science behind it. So it just, it comes straight from my teachings, not my teachings, the teachings that I was given in AA, the book studies that I attend, the what is it called? The lineage of people that I learned from just are diehard book thumpers, and they respect the disease for that, a disease and not a moral failing and not a inconvenience and not a lack of anything other than, no, you have a disease. Something's really wrong with you. And if you can understand that, it kind of gives you the incentive to do something about it.
And you did explain that relief of, oh, it's a disease, so there's a treatment. I'm not just a bad person. I think that's one thing a lot of us feared. I don't know about you, but I've heard, for me, when I was a child, I was so worried I was going to be a bad person or I would do something and I'd get in trouble. And it's like, but I was trying to be good. Why did I get in trouble? And I had this constant brokenness that there was a relief when it's like, oh, okay, there's a treatment.
Yes. If I had not learned that, I never would have recovered. Just like a breast cancer survivor, if they did not believe their cancer was terminal and it was going to kill them unless they took that drastic step of having their breast removed, their disease would have killed them if they did not accept how sick they were. Same thing. Like if nobody took the time to really teach me what the disease of alcoholism really meant, I never would have believed that I was sick enough to have to follow what felt like silly instructions in the beginning.
You spoke about in terms of, I'm still addicted to feel good, you know, completing a task, reading a book, and you're like, I don't want to do any of this shit. I do it because it makes me feel good.
Yeah.
I don't want to do any of this stuff, this service stuff, this, the call to other people, the meetings, the this, the that, the sponsoring. But relief is guaranteed, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the relief that we get, you talked about how much joy you have in your life, and you spoke about your brother in the beginning, and you choked up, and you had so much love for him. Do you feel as though he has been part of your journey throughout the last almost 5 years?
Absolutely. And the healthier I get now, kind of looking at, you know, now I'm striving for emotional sobriety more so than just chemical sobriety. I have chemical sobriety. Now what I need to work on is emotional sobriety. And the more aware of that I become, the more aware I am of how much he impacted me, both in our upbringing together when he was alive and then in his death as an addict. And working with addicts, I work in treatment as well as do 12-step, and I see him in them, you know, and it's gut-wrenching and wishing that things were different. But at the same time, knowing there was that silly NA slogan, and I just disdained it when I heard it at first because I didn't have ears for it. I was just bitter and resentful, and I was so hurt. But now I understand it. They say, some of us have to die so some of us can live. And I thought, fuck you. That's terrible. Why does anybody have to die? I don't want to hear that. But everything serves a purpose. And anytime I go to get really eaten up and mad at God about why him or why my friend Erica or why my friend Evan or Quinn or Brennan, anybody that's died to this disease that I know, I could list countless names. I'm thinking about me in that. I'm thinking about how I feel because they're gone. But what about their suffering? Their God loved them enough to know, okay, that's enough. You know, that's enough. I'm going to give you some relief now. I'm going to put you at ease now, you know, and I can honor their struggle now in doing those things that I don't want to do. because they didn't get an opportunity to do them. You know, some people will never get this thing, even though it's available for everybody. They talk about it in the book, the have-nots and the cannot, I'm sorry, the cannots and the will-nots. And God bless them. Like, how sad is that? You know, some people will never recover. So how dare I think about myself and how sad I am to be without the people I loved, but thank God they're not suffering anymore. And it's cyclical. Their loss creates the incentive for someone like me and hopefully somebody else to think, okay, you're at ease. You're finally at peace. Let me teach somebody about you. Let me share how wonderful you were and how tragic it was that we lost you because you didn't get an opportunity to do the kinds of things that we have to do in program to survive. And just, so it just goes around in a circle. There's no doubt that it's tragic and it's painful and it's horrendous, but it's also valuable. And the silver lining in that is we have that example of what happens if you don't treat your disease.
You spoke about my thoughts no longer have to dictate my actions, that your actions mm-hmm. dictate your thoughts. Talk yes. to me today. How do your actions dictate your thoughts? So for somebody who is not yet sober and listening to this or didn't quite understand that, talk them through what you mean by that.
Just that something that used to be scary, I would just not do it because it was scary. Feeling incapable, I would be incapable. Believe that I was incapable, so therefore why even try? And now as a functional adult, sober in the world, I think I'm not capable all the time. I'm scared of doing things all the time. I'm annoyed at inconvenient things all the time. But I do them anyway. Instead of those thoughts resulting in that thing being impossible, those thoughts just result in thoughts. And my body does the thing that I didn't want to do or didn't think I could do. And then my brain catches up later and says, oh, look at that. You completed that homework assignment that you thought was going to be too difficult. You showed up and had lunch with somebody, even though it was awkward and uncomfortable and weird. You survived. You inconvenienced yourself and helped your friend move. And now you get to earn the rest of your night off and you don't have to feel guilty about it. Kind of those, just those thought processes of just because you don't want to do something doesn't mean that you can't do it. Just because you think you can't do something doesn't mean that you really are incapable. And the more that my body just kind of autopiloted doing the things that I didn't want to do, the more my brain learned, okay, I can do that. I just don't want to. It's not that I can't, I just don't want to. And I was such a prisoner to my thoughts in the beginning. And now my thoughts are still my thoughts. I still think of myself first. I'm still selfish and inconsiderate, but my words don't match and my actions don't match. The longer I've been doing this, the easier it gets. Doesn't eliminate it completely, but it's easier. I have enough experience. I practice the fact that just because my brain tells me something doesn't mean it's necessarily true. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. I was just telling my 10-year-old that literally this morning that you cannot believe all of your thoughts. And you're the only one that can control them. So get it together now and life will be a lot easier. But why? I'm thinking. I love being productive. I love, give me a task. My therapist is like, how do you want to work together? I'm like, give me a task and I will do it. Tell me what to do and I will do it and go check it off the list. And I love that high, like you were talking about.
Yeah.
But I also hate being inconvenienced or I hate doing something. So it's almost like I could come off lazy, except I love being productive, but I want it on my own time. Like it doesn't make any sense. But I have a feeling that you understand.
Abso-friggin-lutely. I understand it.
What is that about?
I don't know what that is other than, for me, a lot of the time, like because I'm so AA wired, like hardcore program wired, that I've kind of learned like maybe too far the opposite end of the spectrum from really feeling crummy about yourself. And because you feel crummy, you have permission to do whatever you want to make yourself feel better, to the other end of the spectrum, which is, you know, put yourself last, everyone else first, service, program. And then you're kind of left depleted. Like, well, what about me? That sometimes I can feel guilty, like taking a day off and laying in bed and not getting dressed or like saying no to a program request, even though I've been taught that you don't do that. And you have to find that balance of like, as long as you prioritize your program, make sure you've checked your boxes of like, are you in the right, you can deserve self-care. For me, self-care is risky because my alcoholic brain will manipulate it into selfishness really quickly. Mm-hmm. So I've learned like little tricks, like, okay, if I'm going to feel guilty for doing nothing all day, what can I do while I do nothing all day? You know, laundry is a good task for me to be feeling productive, but allow myself to relax. I sometimes try to schedule something really uncomfortable and inconvenient on a day off so that I get that thing done. And then my alcoholic brain feels accomplished so that the rest of the day I can truly take off without feeling guilty. Like, I have to get creative sometimes because I still have this disease. It still not dominates, but exists in my life. And I have to treat it accordingly. It no longer comes in the form of, oh my gosh, how am I going to get through the day without a chemical? But it comes in the form of, how am I going to allow myself to relax today? How am I going to show myself some love today without it being selfish and self-seeking? So I don't really know what that is. I don't know if every alcoholic can relate to that or not, but I certainly can. That, like, loving task at hand and very black and white, like, give me a list. I love to check things off, but at the same time, I don't want to do anything.
It makes sense to me. Welcome to the head of Tara.
Yeah.
Tara and Sarah. You are the other half of
Sarah
me.
And Sarah.
Oh my goodness gracious. And I say that all the time. Like, I can't sit around all, if somebody's like, how was your Sunday? Oh, I didn't do anything all day. I just watched Modern Family all day in Schitt's Creek and I feel like shit. And I'm like, that sounds like a great date. No, no, it was
right?
Terrible. It was terrible. I felt terrible.
Dude, I so can relate. People be like, what's wrong? They're like, oh, I just was in bed all day. They're like, that sounds great. I'm like, doesn't it? Doesn't it? Because I kind of hate myself right now.
Right? There's like balance. You said it. You said the word, and I didn't want to hear it. But
yeah, and I'm still working on it.
Balance, you know? And boundaries, right?
Miles to go before I sleep. So much more to learn. This process never ends. And if it didn't keep getting better over time, I wouldn't keep doing it.
Such a good point.
Yeah.
Such a good point. Okay. You concluded your message really nice before I started asking you questions or mostly commentary. But for the alcoholic out there listening, what final message would you like to leave for the suffering alcoholic or addict?
I feel like it's super mundane and frivolous to do the whole like get a sponsor, work your steps, go to your meetings, because we hear that and it's just so unpalatable in the beginning. Like, I don't want that. So what's more digestible? Like, maybe what I wish I remembered what someone said to me in the beginning, that it was like ding, like that's what I needed to hear. And I can't really identify it exactly, but if I was to leave anybody with anything, it's just first and foremost that you're not alone. That I do not doubt that you think that you really are the worst person on earth, or there really is no way out for you. Or if anybody ever knew who you really were, what you'd really done, that they wouldn't want you to get better. That you don't deserve to get better. But just trust that there is something bigger than you in the world that let those things happen for a reason. And if this program was not a proven successful solution to that emotional pain that has been driving your behavior, it didn't work for hundreds of thousands of people all over the globe, not just America, it is international, it is everywhere. If it didn't work, nobody would do it. And obviously what you're doing is not working. So maybe, why not? Just like you're willing to try a different drink or try a different drug, let's try this instead. And if it doesn't work, guarantee you can always go back to the way you were.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.